in his Pentagon Papers. He will be speaking April 28th as part of the 40th anniversary of the protest at Rocky Flats. He will be appearing at Unity Church of Boulder via Skype. That's April 28th at 7 p.m. Tickets are available at kgnu.org.
It's 8:33. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. Sunny skies in the forecast for the Front Range today. Highs in the upper 50s and it looks like we'll have a wind-free day. Hopefully not like the last 24 hours or so. And warming up a little bit more tomorrow. Highs getting up into the mid-60s, but a chance of some rain showers on Friday through Saturday with a little bit of a cooler temperature in the forecast for Friday. Coming up in just under an hour, we will have a morning of music beginning on the Morning Sound Alternative. Tomorrow morning, in honour of Earth Day, which is coming up this weekend, we're going to host a live Fix-It on air with the EcoCycle and the Boulder Fix-It Clinic. We're going to talk about how electronic and technology waste end up in landfills and what that means for the environment and how many things can actually be fixed. We'll have two technicians joining us live in the studio who will be fixing some basic electronics that we all have cluttered in our basement as they get broken, from coffee makers to digital clocks to electronics from the kitchen. We're going to be taking your calls if you've questions on this and discussing broadly the issue of electronic waste. That's tomorrow morning, just after 8:30, right here at KGNU. This morning, in just a moment, it's time for The Real Deal in Sports, which is coming up right after the latest commentary from Jim Hightower.
For some 45 years, it's been my good fortune to team up with Susan DeMarco, my cohort, companion, and co-conspirator in all things progressive and fun. But life comes at you fast, often including an abrupt end to life. Sadly, after a blood clot had slammed into her brain, DeMarco's life ended on April 1st. Yes, April Fool's Day. The only good thing about it is that she departed on her own terms, for she had previously signed end-of-life legal documents directing hospital staff to remove all the tubes and equipment keeping her alive and switch to palliative care, allowing her to die naturally and pain-free. In lieu of flowers, she would simply hope that others would be prompted by her passing to consider controlling their own end time. She was able to die as she wished only because she had signed three legal documents to enforce her wishes: durable power of attorney, declaration of guardian, and advance directive to physicians. As legalistic as all of that sounds, it's not complicated to get and fill out standard forms for all three. Indeed, a recent Medicare provision pays your own doctor to spend time during your physical exams to tell you about, discuss, and assist you free of charge with advanced care planning. Also, most hospitals now hand out the documents for free. Oh, one more thing I learned assisting DeMarco with her exit is that it's not enough to have signed the end-of-life documents. You also need someone who knows where they are when the time comes. Hospital officials cannot take your word that the documents exist. As EMS tended to her, I was frantically searching for her documents in the unmarked piles of stuff around her bedroom, and I could hear her saying, "Come on, Hightower, time to go." But luckily, they were found, and because of that, she was able to depart as she wished. This is Jim Hightower saying, and so can we, if we plan ahead.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome to The Real Deal in Sports, a show about the cultural, social, political, spiritual, and economic impact of sports on the world at large. I'm Josh Chetwin, and thanks for listening in. We also hope you'll contribute with questions and comments, as our phone lines, as always, are open. You can reach us at 303-442-4242. Sports have long been at the forefront of our culture, but today we ask the question, are major commercially driven sports losing their luster as spectator spectacles? Some statistics seem to support this proposition. Consider, NFL TV ratings were down 9% in this past season. This was the second year in a row that NFL viewership saw a decline. Then there are the Winter Olympics, which closed in February as the least watched Olympics on record and was down a steep 7% from the previous Winter Games in Sochi, Russia. And if you think it's just a TV thing, attendance for early season Major League Baseball games are down approximately 10% from 2017. Now, there are potential non-sports reasons to explain away each of these. Donald Trump claimed his opposition to the Take a Knee movement diminished interest in the NFL. The Winter Games had challenging time zone issues for viewers, and particularly cold weather has numbed interest in watching baseball live over the past month. But could there be something more systemic at work as well? Is it possible that the tribalism that sports give fans is fragmenting on some level? Are people choosing more micro-targeted activities to throw their fandom toward, suggesting that even the binding element of rooting for the same home team may soon diminish? Or is it possible that maybe tribalism in general is diminishing and folks are dropping the yoke of fandom for more inclusive pursuits? I'll delve into those and other questions with my two guests. My first guest is George Dorman. He is a senior editor and writer at The Athletic and was formerly an investigative reporter at Sports Illustrated. He's also a Pulitzer Prize winner. He is the author of Play Their Hearts Out, which won the Penn ESPN Award for Literary Sports Writing, the Award for Excellence in Coverage of Youth Sports. And as it relates to this topic, also penned the book Superfans, which delves into the heart of obsessive sports fans. And my other guest is Adam Earnhardt. He is the chair of the Department of Communications at Youngstown State. He is a prolific author and editor, and among his titles is the book Sports Fans, Identity and Socialization, Exploring Fandemonium. George, Adam, thanks both for coming on The Real Deal in Sports.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Great. Thank you both. George, I'd like to start with you, and I sort of began this show by giving some grim statistics as far as fan interest goes, but there are also other factors that could explain those numbers away, which I mentioned as well. Is it a coincidence that these sporting endeavors have recently seen a downturn?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, as you said, the reasons for that are many. I don't think we can just pin it on one thing, but it is not coincidence. I don't know that Donald Trump is wrong, but I also know that, you know, the health issues in football have contributed to that, the decline in participation and viewership of that sport, just to give you one example. So there's a lot of things in play. It's not one thing, but I think the general premise that people are sort of not going to games as much and perhaps not as tethered to a team could be true.
Adam, I had you on the show a year ago talking about fandom generally, and I know there are a lot of psychological elements that draw folks to becoming sports fans. Is it possible that any of those characteristics are lessening? In other words, is the fervency of fandom dissipating a bit, or is it not really that psychological piece that's playing into this?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, we're always looking for things that motivate us to be entertained, and sports is obviously one of those things that... I don't know that the motivations have really changed, though. I mean, one of the main reasons we find that people watch sports is for escape. Now, you brought up Donald Trump and the whole kneeling thing, and in part, one of the reasons why people were complaining about all of that is because, hey, look, if I'm watching sports to escape, and that's my primary motivation, then the last thing that I want to see is something political brought into it, or as you know, you'd mentioned about the injuries too, and concussions. The last thing I want to do is watch something where that's in the back of my mind, or that I'm being prompted to think about it. So those kinds of motivations then are becoming violated, and so if I'm being prompted to then think about those things too, well, then I'm no longer being entertained, and so I may turn my attention to something else.
I mean, George, clearly, you know, not everyone is a hardcore super fan. You wrote a book on sort of that piece of fandom. And when we're talking about whatever diminishing interest there is, it's not 100%. It's a slice of it. what is the difference between those super fans and the people that may be in that 10% that are sort of receding away? And is it possible that that loss of interest is going to expand to sort of get into the more hardcore type of fans? Or are we looking at, you know, that hardcore sort of base will always sort of be there?
I certainly think the people that I, you know, the really hardcore fans that I dealt with in my book are not going anywhere, that they're not impacted in any, their viewership or interest is not, has not been impacted much at all. I do think that the sort of more casual fans have been affected. And I think part of that too is, you know, there's sort of less appointment viewing now. If you're watching sports, like, things that we watch casually, just, oh, I'm not a fan of this team, but I'm just going to watch, you know, the NBA Finals or the Masters or something like that. I feel like that has been declining, and I think part of that is, too, is people are just not watching it. Maybe they're watching it, but they're not watching it at that exact moment it's happening live, because we are now so, you know, so typically watching things on our own time, on demand. We want that of sports as well. So we just don't, you know, those ratings, we just don't tune in for a random game anymore. We'll get to it when we get to it if we want to.
Just a reminder, you're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins. Our topic today is looking at whether major commercially driven sports are losing their luster as spectator spectacles. We've seen ratings and attendance drop in everything from the NFL and Major League Baseball to the Winter Olympics. And we want to get your thoughts on why you think that may be happening and whether you think that's a good thing or perhaps a bad thing. You can reach us, as always, at 303-442-4242. My guests are Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist George Dorman. He's a senior editor and writer at The Athletic and was formerly an investigative reporter at Sports Illustrated. He wrote the book Superfans, which delves into the heart of obsessive sports fandom. And Adam Earnhardt. He is the chair of the Department of Communications at Youngstown State, a prolific writer and editor, and he, among other books, worked on sports fans, identity, and socialization, exploring fandemonium. Adam, I want to pick up one piece here about what sports are trying to do, because they recognize this. I mean, certainly Major League Baseball spent most of this offseason trying to make their games shorter. They think that they're just too long an event. And George mentioned this idea that, you know, we don't really have the casual watching, perhaps, that we had in the past. Is there anything that sports could do to sort of change this trend in this direction? Or is this something that's sort of, you know, going to inevitably continue to unravel?
Well, the fact that they're even talking about it is a step in the right direction. I mean, we've heard these discussions. It almost seemed for years about them wanting to change baseball and change the speed of the game. And then nothing happened. And then they started to see attendance drop. And again, I mean, you talk about attendance dropping. There could be, God, there's a myriad of reasons why attendance is dropping. You mentioned just a few. I mean, let's also not forget too that our attention's being pulled in about a million different directions right now, just in terms of technology, you know, thanks to streaming services and so on. So we could be looking at or watching about a million different things. And so, because of that, you know, the leagues have done a much better job at trying to entice us, trying to create a richer, more fuller experience, trying to give us better access to teams and players and the kind of behind the scenes stuff that we just never had access to before. You know, rolling out new apps, you know, one of the best, we talk about, we're doing a study right now for an update to our ESPN book, but about how, ESPN kind of like set the tone whenever we started rolling out these sports-related apps. And then Major League Baseball came along and just changed everything with their app. So they're trying to do things. And then the other thing that they're trying to do, too, is to bring us back to the stadiums. You mentioned when you and I were corresponding via email before the show, you'd mentioned about the White Sox. There might have been how many people in the stands? Maybe 1,000 people?
Less than 1,000 in one game.
Yeah, I mean, that's remarkable in that. Well, I mean, of course, you can blame it on the weather. That's part of it. I mean, we've had to cancel a few games here in Northeast Ohio and Western Pennsylvania. But But it's clear that these, and you look at the NBA in particular, they're trying to do things to bring people in for a fuller, more fuller, richer experience than just the game itself. I'll tell you just a side story real quickly. I took my five-year-old son to his first Cleveland Cavaliers game a few weeks ago. And I thought, okay, so this is an 8 p.m. game. Okay, he's got school or preschool the next day. I got to wake him up early. So I'm thinking maybe we'll last until 9 o'clock. And no. I mean, he wanted to stay for the whole thing, start to finish. He was so engaged and so enveloped in every little aspect of the stadium. And I said, oh, my gosh, I can remember. There was no way that these games were like this whenever I was a kid. And I think it's one of the ways that they're really trying to pull not just super fans like George is talking about, but even the casual fans, the casual spectators back into the stadiums.
George, to what extent when you were doing your research for your book and in general as someone who's covered sports for many years, is the concept of tribalism an important part of why people are interested, that they put on the shirt of the team that they support and that it gives them a connection to a larger group? And to whatever extent that occurs, how much is that diminishing? How much is that a part that people don't really care about having that connection anymore to the hometown team or to whatever team they support?
I think, I don't know that it's diminishing. I think that's a tricky one to answer. You know, one of the groups in my book that I focus on is the Timbers Army, which is a group that supports, an independent supporters group that follows the Portland Timbers of MLS. And this group is giant. You know, it is a huge group. It has amazing influence in Portland and Oregon. And it's a group that, you know, I write in the book, if you look at sort of the makeup, they're doing charity work all over the state and particularly in the Portland area. They're very supportive of their members. If a member's family dies, it's you know, people will come and help them, bring them dinners. And I make the analogy in the book to what, you know, that Timbers Army is in a way, you know, providing the services that, say, a church group might have provided or a social group like, you know, the Lions Club or the Kiwanis Club used to. So I think that, you know, we all want a group still. That's the natural propensity. And more we're sort of finding that, people are finding that in these fan groups. So I don't know that the idea of grouping, the tribalism, is necessarily declining. I think that's a tricky one to answer. I think just, you know, some of the points that Adam was making are really just impacting those groups. You know, one of the reasons I think that Timbers Army is such a large group and the Portland Timbers are such a success story, and also the Thorns, their women's team, is one of the great, you know, women's sports success stories in America, is simply because those games are 90 minutes. Like, you know, Adam talked about taking his son to the Cavaliers game at 8 o'clock. Who knows when that thing's going to end? How many timeouts are going to be in the last, you know, 2 minutes, right? And the same is true of, you know, college football games and NFL games. One of the beauties, I think, one of the reasons that, you know, a group like Timbers Army and the Portland Timbers are successful in that community is it is an appointment you can go to and you can say, here's the start time and here's the end time. And that's something that we lack in almost all of our other sports. And it really has an impact if you're trying to take your family or, you know, plan a day around one of those events.
But just to follow up, George, to what extent, though, is it fragmenting? Because it seems to me that you can choose your tribe as small as you want nowadays. And I'll give you an example. I'm really into the sport of curling, which is a tremendous minor sport. I can now watch that on the internet on a regular basis. I can drill down my tribalism, my choice of fandom in a way that was impossible in the past. To the extent that the tribe still exists, are they becoming smaller and more discreet and easier to sort of pick your spots rather than, you know, in the 50s and 60s where you were really just having your choice of your home team that you could actually support?
I think the idea of them getting smaller is accurate. You know, we published a story today in The Athletic by Jonette Howard where she talks about a group in Cleveland that is grandmothers for LeBron. Like, it's a group that actually exists of grandmothers who support LeBron. So you do see that. You know, there are these little small groups of Timbers Army followers all over the state, and they're very, like, you know, they consist of 20 people, but this is their group. They're very specific to this area. And so I think you're correct that there are no shortage of groups and sort of subgroups that pop up around these sports teams. And so you do get to choose your lane, and you can tailor sort of the experience, you can tailor to a very sport-specific tribe. So I think that does happen because, as you talk about, we just have so many options now. And so we are so connected that it's really easier to find somebody who, you know, only wants to watch this player play as opposed to, say, this team, or wants to watch this team in this certain way at this certain time.
Adam, do you agree with this premise that there's sort of micro-targeting and sort of this real slicing down of tribes? And if so, what is the impact, both in your mind, on both sports but also on society, and what this says about, you know, how we connect with others in our individual communities and world at large?
Well, it gets back to that. Well, first of all, hey, George, I got to know, wait a minute, are these grandmas for LeBron, are they going to buy a billboard too?
They actually supported him when he went to Miami. Like, they were fine with that.
Oh, you're kidding.
So it's actually,
See, that's a whole cool different side aspect to this, because, I mean, you're talking about tribalism in our teams, but then, you know, you get this whole issue of players leaving. And you know, are the tribes following the team, or are the tribes following the player? I mean, that's a whole different aspect of this that we can't really unpack in an hour. But
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Back to your question. Go ahead.
No. Please. Go.
I was going to say, well, I mean, getting back to your question about tribalism, you know, look, you brought up curling, and I know that's one of your favorite sports, but were we really talking about curling a decade ago? I mean, and so you've got not just curling, but all of these other, and I was talking about all of these ways we're being distracted, all of these other interests that we have that, quite frankly, we didn't have 10 years ago. You know, I always like, we, you know, as sports scholars and communication scholars and media scholars, we always point back to, you know, the most watched television event is the Super Bowl, and before that it was the final series episode of MASH, right? Well, okay, great. So if you go back and look at MASH, you know, back in the, I don't even remember when this was, in the 80s, early 80s, I think it was, we had very few other distractions in terms of media. And now we've got all of this other stuff, including all of these other interests, like things like curling and other sports that we could be becoming interested in. And so because of that, yeah, I think there is the possibility of kind of whittling down or narrowing down of the tribes.
I guess the question then is what is the outcome of that? I mean, sports, for all its failures, and there's certainly, you know, I've spent many times on this show talking about the negative side, it can also be sort of a galvanizing force. It can be a bring together. You know, you think of the Red Sox with Boston Strong after the Boston Marathon tragedy, terrorism attack. That it can serve as a place where people kind of come together. If we're not coming together there, does sports lose one of its more valuable cachets?
Well, yeah, George was kind of talking about the Timbers group coming together to do things like that, and we see that with groups of fans all the time. Do we become less community service minded? I guess, is that your question?
Yeah, well, it's that in terms of a place where people can come together as community, sports has served, major commercial sports have served as one of those rallying points, one of those places where you can come together, have shared interests, and also do shared things in a broader tribal sense. We start slicing down the tribes that much, if we start breaking it up too much, do we lose one of our spots within a community where we can sort of all get together and overcome maybe some other differences? Is that a problem?
And celebrate. Yeah, I don't think that ever really goes away. I mean, I think because of the word actual, like, community. Okay, so would we have this if sports didn't exist? I say yes. I say we would just have it in a different form, and we would rally around some other, you know, different thing. And I hate to use the word thing, but, you know, who knows what that would be. I think because we want to support and and promote these pro-social behaviors, that we would find ways to kind of rally around each other and support each other. Sports just happens to be the mechanism right now for doing that. I don't really think that that's going away. In fact, if anything, I think that that's being even promoted on a broader, grander scale. It might look like it's being fractured because, again, we're all of our interests are being pulled away, but I think it's still there.
Yeah, George, feedback on that.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was saying, you know, feedback on that. I think about like the esports phenomenon. Like you have a lot of young people right now who could care less about, say, the NFL, but are really engaged with esports. They know who the best players are. They themselves are playing. You know, I mean, gosh, like if you look at some of the media companies, they've invested heavily in coverage of esports. It's kind of the same thing. If you were, you know, a big fan of the Dallas Cowboys, instead you're doing this. It's exactly what Adam's talking about, which is they're still finding that connectivity, that tribe. It's just around something else. And I think it's hard for sort of people who've long been sports lovers or are so dedicated to their favorite school or their favorite team to understand, well, you don't have a favorite team. You don't have a favorite school. You're not, you don't live and die with this team. That's hard for people to understand because it's been such a huge part of who we are as Americans for so long. But it clearly is happening where especially younger people are not choosing a sports team or, you know, a franchise or a school to create that connection and tribe.
George, if you're Rob Manfred, who's the commissioner of Major League Baseball or running one of the other major sports leagues, is this a reason for concern for you, though? I mean, I know there's sort of the obvious economic imperative concern, just, you know, fewer, you know, viewers means lower ratings, which means lower rights fees down the road. But is this more systemic change sort of suggests more broader concern for their viability in the long run?
I think so. And I think, you know, this is maybe a simplified answer, but I think participation is, they're looking at their participation numbers. Who's playing baseball? Because really that's where you know, the NFL has done all this research to determine that, you know, they got to get kids playing football. So they've now, and they realize moms aren't going to let their kids play tackle football, so they're investing heavily in flag football. They know they have to form a connection somehow. And if I'm baseball, one of my major concerns is that, you know, are the participation numbers. Are kids not getting connected to baseball at a young age? That's the real concern here, which then trickles sort of up or down, depending on how you want to look at it. It trickles up in some sense when they get older, they're just not connected and it's not where they find their tribe. It's not where they form that connection and stuff. But I think, you know, there's, as you said, there's the economic issues, but, you know, they have to work on the prices. I mean, MLS games are cheaper. That's one of the reasons why, you know, a Timbers Army or the Thorns, the women's team there are popular. It's not so expensive, you know, but these other sports, especially like the NFL, are simply so expensive. Who can afford, you know, four tickets to an NFL game? It's tough. And so I think they should be concerned. Anybody who's running a league right now, maybe other than the NBA and MLS, should be very concerned.
The time is 9 in the morning. Just a reminder, you're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins. Our topic today is looking at whether major commercially driven sports are losing their luster as spectator spectacles. Are we splintering as tribes and no longer just rooting for the home team, but finding our own space in sports, or just receding from sports? We'd love to hear your opinions and thoughts on those topics. You can call us, as always, at 303-442-4242. Adam, I want to get your thoughts on something that George was saying. He was talking about sort of the younger fan base, millennials, and I guess after millennials, Generation Z or the I generation, whatever we're now calling that next generation. I'm sure that will coalesce at some point with one singular name. But how do they fit into this equation in your mind? I mean, are they even more likely to sort of choose their own path and pull away from the traditional sports or leave sports altogether? I mean, they're going to be a huge key to wherever sports goes as, you know, a spectator opportunity. Where do you see them going?
Yeah, so, well, number one, George is right on about esports. Oh, my gosh. So we just got back from the National Association of Broadcasters just had their convention in Vegas. And I had heard about this coming to Vegas, and I'd never really fully, you know, bought into, you know, whether or not it was going to take off here in the United States like it did in places like South Korea, for example, where it's esports are just, you know, they're bigger than LeBron James in South Korea. And as we're getting our Uber into the down towards the Luxor, I don't know if you've seen this or if you've been to Vegas in the last month or so, but the entire side of the Luxor, and by the way, for your listeners who don't know what the Luxor is, it's the big pyramid that shoots the big spotlight out the top up into the sky. The entire side, one side of the Luxor, is an advertisement for their new esports arena. Now, if that doesn't tell you about the importance of esports, especially for this younger generation, in terms of what it means to them and the economic value behind it, then there's nothing more telling than when Vegas gets behind it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that when I saw it, I'm like, okay, well, I think esports is finally coming to its own. It's now got its own advertisement on the side of the Luxor in Las Vegas. Those are the kinds of things that I think that every major league franchise and league that's looking for ways to attract younger fans to their sports, that's the way to do it. And I think, you know, and George is right on, one of the ways to do it is through esports. I had mentioned another way is to, you know, find ways to make these live sporting events more richer experiences. One of the things that we saw, for example, this year with the All-Star, the NBA All-Star game, was this whole, you know, the way that they announced the lineups and brought the lineups into it and made, you know, LeBron and Steph were kind of picking their teams, and there was that whole drama behind that. I mean, those kinds of things get younger players, younger viewers excited about sports in ways that we would have never expected, because it kind of plays into those narratives that younger fans experience whenever they play esports games and things like that, like picking their own lineups and so on. So I think that they're kind of playing into that. They're kind of trying to figure out how to do that and attract those fans with those new strategies.
You know, it's interesting. You both have referenced the NBA in different contexts. They are the outlier amongst the major spectator sports in that their ratings were actually up during the regular season. I think it was right around 8%. And George, when you look at that, do you see, you know, a lot of lessons to be learned in terms of how to approach people's interest in sports right now?
I think, yeah, you know, especially because their numbers are up with young people. One of the things that that they've done is the NBA is a personality league. It is a players league, right? Like, think about, you can go on to ESPN right now, and they have a whole, you know, montage of just things that Russell Westbrook wore this year, his fashion. They have columnists who just talk about the shoes that players wear, who wore the best shoes this week. The NBA does an amazing job working with its broadcast partners like ESPN or Turner, which owns Bleacher Report as well, you know, to market players, to sell the game as a players league, a personality league. Contrast that with, say, the NFL, which is always trying to make it a team. I mean, they don't even let players wear their own shoes or socks that are different, right?
You still there, George? I think we're having some technical difficulties. Just a reminder, you're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. We've lost George for a moment, but we do have a caller. It's John. John in Boulder, you're on KGNU Radio.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I haven't been listening for too long, but just wanted to chime in on the topic. When I was growing up, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, sports were really a big part of my life, thinking about, you know, the different games and the teams that were playing. And but for my son now, it's really it's just almost doesn't exist for him. And there's a few things that I think has to do with it. For one thing, we don't have cable, so it's like whatever we get on the rabbit ears is going to be what we watch, and, you know, there's hardly any games on. And I don't really watch them that much because there's so many commercials and product placement and also the military, you know, product placement. And there's just an endless stream of commentary and commentators that I find very annoying. And also the rules. Like for football, I find it incredibly annoying to watch the game because of the rule changes and the instant replays and everything. So it's just not a very enjoyable experience for me.
Yes. Yeah. Question, when you were younger, did you go to a lot of sporting events? And do you no longer do that with your son? Does he not have interest in attending?
Yes. Yeah, I can remember, you know, going to a number of Yankee games, Cosmos soccer games, and, you know, when I was a kid. And yeah. I have not taken my son to a game at all. I mean, the last time I saw the Broncos, once again, it was really annoying, all the just with the screens and explosions and the music and everything. I have no desire to go to back to a sporting event because of that.
And does your son ever sort of try to instigate any of that, or is it really just not on his radar?
Not really, yeah. I mean, he, you know, they went to a Rockies game once when he was, you know, maybe eight, and he was just like, ah, it was okay, you know, no big deal. But, right. Yeah, for me, it was a thrill, you know, going to see the Yankees in 78 or whatever. It was great.
Right, right. Yeah, it has certainly changed. Sean, thank you so much for your comments. Just a reminder, you're listening to the Real Deal in Sports on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. We have our two guests in Adam Earnhardt, who is the Department of Communications Chair at Youngstown State. He's written numerous books and edited numerous other books, including Sports Fans, Identity and Socialization, Exploring Fandemonium. And we do have George Dorman back as well. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and he is also the senior editor and writer at The Athletic and was formerly an investigative reporter at Sports Illustrated. He's written multiple books, including the book Superfans, which delves into the heart of obsessive sports fandom. George, we lost you for a moment. I know you were in the midst of talking about the NBA and sort of what its unique strategy is to sort of counter what seems to be a trend towards the larger commercial sports and their difficulties with fandom. You want to continue a little bit more? Do you have a little more to say on that?
Yeah. Sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened there, but I think, you know, and maybe I'm repeating what you guys heard. I don't know when we dropped off, but they're just so good. The NBA is just so good at making it about personalities. And so, you know, they don't try to quiet their players. They don't try to make them uniform in terms of, you know, like the way they appear on the court or, in and off the court. So they encourage them to be outspoken, and they welcome it. And so I think that really appeals to younger people. They're individuals. They're not a group. You know, when we were, you know, older, not myself and older people who watched sports, we talked about the team. When we root for this team, there are people who just root for players. I don't live in Oklahoma City, but I'm a huge Russell Westbrook fan because I love how he dresses and expresses himself, like that kind of an attitude. So the NBA sees that, and they're really smart about not discouraging it, but going the opposite direction. Whereas the NFL, just for one, seems to be, you know, hell-bent on making its players faceless. And I think that's a big mistake when it comes to trying to appeal to younger fans.
Adam, is that our future in terms of our interest in sports? You've both have made the point that individuality is something that appeals particularly to the younger demographic. And, you know, George gives the example of the grandmothers who are just fans of LeBron James. And esports is obviously very personality driven. Is that what we're going to see in the future if we're looking at sports? That sports remain, but that's going to be one of the real monumental changes to the way we watch and support them?
Oh, yeah, it's already changing. And actually, I'd like to go back and reference your caller, John, you know, who talked about how sports have changed so much since he watched them. He's absolutely right. And that's actually one of the – I'm sure George has heard this too, but it's one of the reasons why if there are reasons why fans, even fanatics, turn their back on sports that they used to love, it's because – of all of those changes in sports and the way the games have changed and so on. And so I think that because of that, there may be more of this interest in just celebrating the individual athlete and supporting that individual athlete. Now, I will say this. George is right on. I mean, the whole reason why, you know, you don't see kind of the political statements on or being criticized in the NBA is because almost from the outset, the NBA has supported those kinds of behaviors. But why the NFL took that stance and didn't take a cue from the NBA is beyond me.
It's 9:13 a.m. You're listening to The Real Deal in Sports on KGNU. If you want to get in a call here before the end of our hour, which ends at 9:30, please give us a ring at 303-442-4242. George, is any of this an inherently American dynamic? And I ask this because, you know, you mentioned the Timbers and soccer up in the Pacific Northwest. When you look at the interest in soccer, or as they call it in Europe, football, there still is that tribalism of team that seems to remain very robust. If you're following, English Premier League soccer, for example, people wear their shirts with great pride, and it becomes a central part of identity in that culture. And it's true in other European cultures and in Latin America. That hasn't seemed to be shaken the way we're seeing it occur perhaps in the U.S. So is there something American about what's going on here, or am I sort of misstating what you see as the current trend?
You know, I think a little bit of both. I think there is, right now, I think soccer is cool. It's cool to be, again, for most younger people, it's really cool to be, you know, to watch English soccer or European soccer, to have a team, to wear a jersey. MLS is really popular with younger people. And if you live in Portland, it's cool to be part of the Timbers Army, to be part of that group. So I think that soccer is you know, it's new here. I think there are going to be so many people who are shaking their heads and saying things like, oh, come on, it's not really that popular. And frankly, it's not that popular probably in Colorado, just given that team there and their troubles. But in other parts of the country, it's just getting huge. Look at Atlanta. You know, they have their team is just a couple years old, and they're drawing 60,000 plus to games. Right, Orlando, same thing. So this is it's hugely popular for a lot of reasons. It's just a really cool sport. But I think that one of the really telltale signs to me that, you know, soccer is going to become one of the sports that grows and doesn't retract in the way that maybe football or baseball might, is that the people who are buying MLS teams right now, a lot of them are NFL owners or owners of other professional teams. And I look at that as guys hedging their bets. I look at them saying, wow, that's a good investment. So, you know, when the 49ers owners buy a team that isn't even in MLS in Sacramento, but they're hoping it will be, when they invest in that, I think they're hedging. That's the way that I look at it. And I also think they're seeing the trend lines and saying, with young people, this sport is huge.
Is there something unique in soccer then? Because, you know, again, going back to this idea of sort of sustained fandom of the tribalism, certainly in Europe, it doesn't seem to be waning. You're suggesting it's occurring in the U.S. Is there something that sort of binds something about the soccer culture that binds fans in a way that's different than a baseball or a football or even the Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, it has a lot of things. I'm sorry. I mean, it has a lot of things that appeal to people. It's somewhat of a bar sport, right? It's a sport that you go to the bar, then you go to the game. So it's really social. You watch games. You go to places to watch games. People do that for other sports too, but remember, it's 90 minutes, so it has a cap on it. And I think that is an important factor. It is a league where personalities, generally speaking, the sport across the world, where personalities, it's more NBA-like in this way. Think of like Zlatan Ibrahimovic in L.A. coming to the L.A. Galaxy and saying, "You're welcome, Los Angeles, I'm here," right? These are personalities, Cristiano Ronaldo and others who express themselves. And so I think that it has more in common with the NBA than it does with the team concept, you know, faceless players that you might see in the NFL.
Adam, I want to put you on the system. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to follow up real quickly to that. Another thing, because you mentioned about the similarities to the NBA. You know, we've had, and I'm not at all trying to be sexist here, but we've had several women who have served as respondents on a lot of these surveys who have said, you know, one of the main reasons why they enjoy soccer is because they can actually see faces. So they can see, so there are no helmets, right? So with football, with hockey, even with baseball to some extent, you know, we have caps or batter's helmets or catcher's masks or whatever. Their faces are there. You can see, I can see, I know when Harden or LeBron James or somebody is running up and down the floor because I can actually see them. I see the beard. I see the face. It's hard for the casual spectator. It's hard for them sometimes to pick out where their favorite player is because their player is being hidden by a mask. Now, I know that sounds to the Uber fan, the super fan, like that's, you know, how dare you say something like that, but it's very true for the casual spectator.
It's interesting because I think one of facts that we're sort of pulling out of this discussion is that what's sort of driving sports interest in a lot of ways now is individuality, which is different probably from a generation ago. And Adam, what does that say about Americans, or just sports fans in general? Because there's a suggestion here that's sort of also an international dynamic. What does it say about us that we're sort of more? Is it about sort of that individual fame that we sort of glom onto that we see in sort of reality TV and elsewhere? That you know we just want to sort of kind of be fans of people instead of fans of teams.
Well, we're not a collectivist culture. We never have been. I mean, that's China. That we are an individualistic culture, so it just makes sense that that's the kind of ideal that we would celebrate. I mean, why not? So that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, that's just a cultural value that Americans have had for, you know, since our birth, I would think.
But to push back on that just a little bit, that may be true, but when we look at our sports fandom in the 20th century, it was much more team-driven, you know? Yeah, you had your favorite player on the Yankees, but you were a Yankees fan. And now we're saying, no, I'm not a Yankees fan. I'm a Giancarlo Stanton fan first and foremost.
Yeah, there's that plays into it too as well. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is I think you can play it both ways. I think there are people who will go out and say I'm a fan of this particular team because that's my identity. That's how I celebrate. But you know, you're right, and I think George is right to this idea that people are glamming on to holding on to these individual athletes, especially people that they've followed for such a long time that maybe in the twilight of their careers or maybe even mid-career pick up and move to a different team. It used to be that we didn't follow that athlete. In fact, you know, and there are still even some recent cases with Isaiah Thomas leaving the Boston Celtics, not on his own accord, or before that with LeBron James going to Miami, where you know, they've burnt jerseys, as a way to kind of say, well, you know, you violated my identity. Well, that's kind of changing in that, you know, people are willing to pick up and follow that athlete with whatever team that they go to.
Great. We have another caller. It's Jim in Boulder. Jim, you're on KGNU Radio.
Last night I read this Matt Taibbi article in the Rolling Stone, and it seemed to be complaining about Facebook and Google splitting up people into tiny groups and then trying to get as much FaceTime as possible so that more outrageous things. So he's actually at the end saying that we need to somehow break up Google and Facebook the way long time ago some of the oil companies were broken up. Of course, they need to be broken up again because they've remonopolized again. But anyway, it might be interesting for you guys to read his article or think about if our, like he says, 70% of the people get their news by Facebook and Google, not from newspapers anymore. So, and the news is very individualized to try and, to based on what you've looked at before and how long, to try and get you to watch that particular little thing and to be upset. And anyway, so it's different than yelling in a group at a basketball game, feeling together to have some little private thing just for you. And he thinks it's sort of very near to 1984 and we need to break them up because it's as if the government is in charge of everything except it's Facebook and Google. Bye.
Great. Thank you, Jim. George, I just want to ask you, because there's an interesting element to this, which is the idea of sports having a monopoly. I mean, as we know, baseball famously has been able to legally sidestep antitrust laws. Are we seeing a time where there will be that sort of breakup, that maybe some of the damage that these, you know, in terms of interest that we're seeing here is sort of the start to seeing these major leagues across different sports start to fragment even within their sport themselves?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it's possible that the future for these big leagues, baseball, the NFL, is that they're sort of more boutique, right? That they appeal to a smaller audience, but one that is, you know, very passionate, that spends a lot more money, that will sort of live and die with it, that sort of the cash, that it just sort of gives up on the more casual fan and becomes, you know, something that's just strictly for the diehards. I mean, I think we might be heading there anyway, whether their business model, you know, how long until they just embrace their smaller market with the diehards versus trying to draw in more casual fans. I mean, the NFL is marketing to children at really young ages. They're doing incredible marketing and heart, you know, tugging with moms and women to try to get them to stay engaged with football. I mean, they're trying to be broad because that's obviously you make more money. At some point, do they just say, gosh, you know, we don't have the appeal, the broad appeal, and we should become more narrow? I think that's probably where we're headed as a society. That's probably inevitable that some of these leagues, if not all of them, become more niche.
Is there, though, a bit of a too-big-to-fail situation here, the amount of money that is outlaid from these leagues on player salaries, you know, the stadiums that have been built, that if, in fact, that happens, it's going to require some of these leagues to collapse upon themselves in an epic manner before we get to that point?
We've seen that on a smaller scale already, with some of these teams picking up and moving.
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, I think that's happening on a smaller level, but the leagues are still trying to, you know, keep the balls in the air. George, you were going to say something?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say we've seen leagues talk about international expansion, right? And I think one of the reasons they're doing that is an acknowledgement that they're running out of sort of ports here in the United States that they can get a stadium built or, you know, get taxpayer dollars for different ways, in different ways. So I think we're seeing, you know, these teams are there. There's some leagues that are scrambling. There's some leagues that are trying to reposition themselves to survive. I think that, you know, whether they're too big to fail, you know, I think that, you know, things like college football, because how entrenched it is in certain communities, like, say, Alabama football, Auburn football, Mississippi football, Georgia football, you know, Notre Dame football. Like, they're so entrenched. I think in some ways they're too big to fail because they're so large in their community. But I don't think that what we're seeing, the trend lines with an NFL or a Major League Baseball team or hockey teams or things like that, I don't think that they're so, you know, they're so bulletproof that it's going to not happening overnight, but I don't think they're so bulletproof that we don't see, someday the NFL talk about retraction and getting smaller as opposed to, expansion.
We're just about the end of our hour, and I want to get in one more caller. Jay in Boulder, you're on KGNU.
Hey, good morning. Thank you guys for having this conversation, and I'll keep it real brief. You mentioned soccer as pulling in a lot of fans, and I think a big part of that is accessibility. You know, you mentioned esports as well and its popularity amongst the youth today, and I think whether it's, you've got to be a super tall individual for basketball or, a big, burly, guy for football with all kinds of equipment and stuff. Soccer is a common person's sport. It's easy to partake in and be part of. And, I just wanted to add that to the conversation as far as the accessibility of whether it's getting to a location, parents bringing their children to participate in a sport or whatever it is. Esports seem to be something that kids can do at any point, and adults as well. So I just wanted to add that. Thank you guys so much for having this conversation.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're absolutely right, because, Ronaldo or, some of these soccer players, there's no way they could ever play any other sport. I mean, that's what I like to think. I mean, they're these, tiny guys, and I mean, they're incredibly athletic, but when you see them standing next to other superstar athletes, it's like night and day.
We have really about a minute left, unfortunately. We do have one other caller. It's Cree from Fort Collins. Cree, you have about 30 seconds, but I want to give you a chance to get on the air here on KGNU.
Okay, thanks. Fascinating discussion, and I just wanted to comment that as far as this individual player identity goes, I'm 41, and the meme on Facebook that was being circulated about Colin Kaepernick, if he was signed by the Broncos, they would actually go to a Broncos game again. I would have to echo that sentiment, and I'm someone who's never been interested in organized sports, especially not football, my whole life, but people like Colin Kaepernick and seeing players speak out and give some kind of social context to the sport makes me a lot more interested. And it's great that the NBA has done that with some of their players over the years, and being able to speak out, to the circumstances that people are growing up in impoverished areas in the United States, and Black Power and all that. So I want to see more of that in sports, and that would actually make me more interested in going to a game.
Wonderful. Cree, thank you so much for your thoughts. And it brings up a really interesting final point here before I have to hand the mic over, which is that NBA is the one sport that seems to be expanding. It also seems to be in some ways one of the more socially conscious sports. And one wonders moving forward whether or not that will be something that can go hand in hand if major commercial sports want to continue to succeed. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I really want to thank both of our guests for being on the show. Pulitzer Prize winning journalist George Dorman, who is a senior editor and writer at The Athletic and was formerly an investigative reporter at Sports Illustrated. He's the author of Play Their Hearts Out, which won a Penn ESPN Award for Literary Sports Writing, the Award for Excellence in Coverage of Youth Sports, and also penned the book Superfans, which delves into the heart of obsessive sports fandom. And Adam Earnhardt, who is coming on for a second time on this show, so thank you, Adam, for that. He is a chair of the Department of Communications at Youngstown State. He is a prolific author and editor, and among his titles is the book Sports Fans: Identity and Socialization, Exploring Fandemonium. Thank you, each and every one of you, so much for listening. I've been your host, Josh Chetwynd, and next up, please stay tuned for Uncle Jeff and the Morning Sound Alternative. Blue. They put me in
extra 10%. She tried to please me on my leave, so I'm living in a tent. The outcome of the income tax will certainly ruin me. How I hate to pay that tax on shoes. And now they've even put the jail on soda fountain drinks. It's sure a shame, but lay the blame on those taxation blues. Those taxation blues. Those taxation blues. They put me in corner, but they brought the panic on. My poor old pocketbook is bare from that extra little 10%. In the park and let them wait till after dark. I tell you, friend, put an end to those taxation
blues.
That was a funky one.
Like an old time movie, but a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark, or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me. And I will never be set free as long as I'm a ghost that you can't see. Could read your mind, love, what a tale your thoughts could tell. Just like a paperback novel, the kind the drugstore sells. When you reach the part where the heartaches come, the hero would be me, but heroes often fail. And you won't read